Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look at the long-standing debate over bilingual education in Arizona.
And the fight to oust two Arizona Supreme Court justices in November just got a little more interesting.
But first, people die in the Grand Canyon every year. So far this year, that number is up to 11, above average for the park. But there is an entire team of people there who work to stop that from happening. It's called Preventative Search and Rescue, or PSAR, and they are tasked with trying to teach people how to prepare and plan for a hike in the canyon and to rescue them when there are emergencies, a task our first guest this morning told me is not always possible. Megan Smith coordinates the team. I spoke with her more about their work and the need for it.
The team began in the late 90s, but the park knew that it needed to do something different. They were averaging upward of 4 to 5 trail deaths or heat-related deaths per year, and it was just not sustainable for the staff they had at the time. Rangers from the Inner Canyon weren't able to get to their duty station locations. They were just stuck out on the trail in this endless loop, helping people all day into the night. And the South Rim Rangers were having to go down, leave their duty location and their otherwise important work to go down trail and offer assistance. So they entered in this team in the late 90s, early 2000s. We were starting to formalize more. The team was growing. Now it hovers around 60 to 70 volunteers and one permanent ranger and between 7 and 9 permanent rangers.
So it sounds like there were, you know, many issues with the dangers of hiking in the Grand Canyon then. But have you seen this ramp up? Like we keep getting reports now of hikers being rescued or even dying in the Grand Canyon because of the heat. Like, has that really changed the operation there?
You know, I'm glad that you asked specifically that question, because the messaging, when I look back at old archives and old data and I'm doing research, the messaging hasn't changed a whole lot. Know your limitations. Don't hike between 10 and 4. Pack and be prepared. Have a contingency plan. I look back at these bullets and the font in which they're written has changed a whole lot, but not the messaging.
Have you seen more people getting themselves into tough situations and needing assistance or even rescuing?
Yeah, we're not seeing maybe more calls for service. We're still hovering around about 350 missions per year. But what is changing is the situations. People are calling us for more benign things. I would say that people's understanding of what a true emergency is very interesting and open for interpretation.
What kinds of things do they call for?
Well, we've had people that call us because they're afraid of the dark. We have people that call us because their cell phone's out of batteries. It can be hazardous. We understand. And I don't mean to make light of it. We do take people's calls seriously, but we're faced with triaging those. And the risk that I want people to understand is we can get fatigued. And if we increase that call volume on an ever-shrinking staff, then when the serious call comes in, we might miss something. We might not be at the top of our game. We might be suffering from compassion fatigue, and we're not able to be at our best, or we might be expending resources in the wrong location for something that's more benign and not able then to pivot efficiently and go to the really serious thing that we would otherwise want to be at or know that we need to be at.
That's really interesting. So that's not the change I expected to hear you talk about. Talk about when it does get serious and the rescues that you have to make. Like, can you always rescue people in the Grand Canyon?
No. In fact, I've been down there overnight with quite seriously injured or ill people, and overnighting somebody that really does need to be flown out and get to surgery or get to the ICU, those are tenuous circumstances to be in. That's really where you kind of test yourself as a provider and a rescuer and your team, and you understand if you're right for this work or not. We get stuck out, and that's a reality. Being able to explain to the visitor or your patient or your patient's family what that means and the why behind it. It could be the weather conditions, wind conditions. It could be light. We just don't fly at night. It could be our resources. There's all sorts of things that would lead us to not being able to come and rescue you or come and rescue you as immediately as maybe you would want.
Wow.
Or your situation might require.
Right. I mean, so do you think that people have an understanding of that? Like, so many millions of people go to the Grand Canyon every year, right? And like, I'm sure a lot of them do a hike or attempt to or do some of a hike, right? Like, is there a sense that this is a fun thing that millions of people do, so it's going to be fine, you think? And people don't really understand the real risks?
Yeah, there's definitely an air of not me, not today, mm-hmm. you know, kind of some denial. One of the things that we train our staff here about is this trifecta. We are, for better or worse, very closely and relational to Las Vegas mm-hmm. and to Disneyland in California. And you'd think, well, what does that have to do with anything? But if a visitor is coming from across the world and they're going to visit those other two locations, which, by the way, are wonderful locations, but yeah. they're very strategically manicured and managed for safety.
Right.
That's not the case here at the Grand Canyon. You have to make those risk management decisions all on your own without walkways and red lights and conveyor belts and escalators and all of those things. So if you've been traveling and you're in the wrong mindset and you come here, one misstep near the edge could be catastrophe. Or a short hike that just should just be just out for a couple hours turns into a big deal.
Wow. That's, I mean, you want people to be able to come there, right? Like, though, so it's an interesting tension because I'm sure you love the Grand Canyon. I'm sure you appreciate the place and want to share it with all of these people from all over the world who come. But it sounds like, I mean, you almost want people to come and do this in a certain way, like with a certain attitude. Is it respectful? Is there a tiny smidge of fear you would like people to have?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those would all be more self-protective. Okay. And I think with caution and awareness, some planning, preparedness, it is doable. It is achievable, but you got to be honest with your own limitations and your own abilities.
That's really interesting. So tell us, like, I know there's a long list of things that you tell people to do and to consider. What's at the top of that list? Like, are there things that people just don't think about?
The most common is they don't understand that it gets hotter as you go downhill. Right. I didn't know when I got here. I'm yeah. from Western New York, and I didn't even think about this mountain being upside down, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so having some supplies with you makes a big difference. I've seen visitors that are able to pull themselves out of a pickle with very little, but at least they brought it with them.
Like what?
Oh, duct tape goes a long way. Here, when it gets really hot, your shoe soles can melt off your feet. Imagine trying to hike on a really hot surface that's pokey with rocks and, you know, cactus needles and things. And now you don't have any shoes because the glue is melted and your shoe delaminated. So
oh my God.
Having just yeah. a small spool of duct tape, having basic first aid supplies, having your medications that you take on a daily basis. One of the best teachers here is Mother Nature and experiential learning. We give the information. We hope that they take our advice, but ultimately some people just really need to go learn the hard way or get through it, prove to themselves that they can do it. The one exception there, I would say, is when there are children or animals involved.
Yeah.
We want people to participate in their public lands. We don't want to be gatekeeping in any manner. But there's just some scenarios that we have been here doing this work long enough. We know the math isn't going to add up and end well.
Yeah.
Aside from that, they could have a hard hike and still come out. A few blisters, maybe a little nausea, maybe some vomiting, healthy respect, and then they'll feel a sense of pride and accomplishment. And then my hope is that they return and get into these spaces a little deeper and have a more successful trip the next time around.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Megan Smith, Preventive Search and Rescue Coordinator at Grand Canyon National Park. Megan, thank you for coming on. This was fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
The role of bilingual education in Arizona has been the topic of litigation this year, as State School Superintendent Tom Horn sued school districts that use dual language models to teach English to students for whom it's not their native language. Horn argued the models violate a 2000 voter-approved measure, which required those students to be taught in English immersion programs. Even though a judge dismissed that suit, a new one has been filed, which is still pending. The issue of and controversy surrounding how best to teach English to students who don't already speak it is a long-standing one in Arizona, and it's something my next guest has studied in depth. Laura Munoz is an assistant professor of history and ethnic studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Her debut book is called Desert Dreams, Mexican Arizona and the Politics of Educational Equality. I spoke with her earlier about her research and asked how far back she was able to trace the question of how best to teach English to this population of students.
This question goes all the way back to the 1860s. In 1871, Arizona's territorial legislature created a public school system. It was co-sponsored by Esteban Ochoa, who was the territorial legislator from Tucson, and Governor Safford, Anson P.K. Safford. It was known as the Safford-Ochoa Act. And that particular public school act required English language training. So it was understood that there were schools already in existence in Tucson, in the vicinity, and in other areas of what we now consider the state of Arizona, where folks were already operating small community or day schools, and oftentimes that education in those schools was taking place in Spanish. So when the territorial legislature endorsed this territory-wide schooling act, it required English to be taught.
What was the thinking behind making that requirement?
The thinking had to do with this new population as Anglo-Americans moved into the territory and became part of established Mexican communities. There was this question of language and how do they communicate with one another? What should be the official language of the territory? English was an important language for American politics, but Spanish was the predominant language of the citizenry. Anglos spoke Spanish. Most people in the region were multilingual, speaking indigenous languages, traveling literally across the entire Southwest, not only from Mexico up north, all the way to St. Louis, Missouri, but also far west into California. There were so many different languages spoken. Spanish and English became the two predominant languages because those were the languages of the two colonial nations, Mexico and the United States.
So at what point did this really become a controversy, I guess, in the sense that maybe English speakers mm-hmm. wanted all students to be mostly taught in English, and if they weren't mm-hmm. going to be, then they maybe had to go to different schools?
Well, in the 1870s, the territorial county superintendents of education are reporting back to the territorial governors, and the territorial governors reporting back to the federal government in Washington, D.C., and in those reports, they're talking about the need to teach English to the population. So this is an issue from the creation of a U.S. government within the region. They don't let go of this issue. It becomes a consistent issue that's reiterated with, you know, each new governor, each new set of territorial legislators. They're always discussing this question of the English language. In fact, they called it a Mexican problem. And that's the term that teachers and superintendents were using when they would talk about the Spanish-speaking student population. Now, one of the ways that this issue of language became negotiated is that Mexican or Arizonense families, as I call them, decided, particularly in Tucson, to invest in the creation of private schools and also Catholic schools. And in those schools, which had a much higher attendance than, for example, the Tucson public schools, I want to say something like 500 to 1,000 children of Spanish-speaking heritage were attending the Catholic diocesan schools in Tucson, whereas only a couple hundred were attending the public school in Tucson in the 1870s and 1880s. And that's because Mexican-American parents were sending their children to schools where bilingual education would be valued and would be taught.
It sounds like you can really make an argument that the origin of Arizona school choice is based on bilingualism.
I would say yes. And what's interesting too is that this idea that parents would have control, local control of schools, was actually written into the original school laws. Initially, parents who lived within a 2-mile radius could create their own school district. And so the teacher that would get hired in that public school, whether it was a ranch school or a school near a mining community or a school in a, in what we think of as major metropolitan areas like Phoenix nowadays, the parents would form the school board and then they would hire their own teacher. And then they would negotiate with the teacher how school would be taught.
It seems as though there was a difference of maybe strategy in Tucson versus other places, maybe in the Phoenix area, Tempe, other places in the central part of the state, when it comes to bilingual education. First off, is that a fair assessment? And if so, any sense of why that might have been?
Well, I think in Tucson, because it's an established community in the 1860s and 70s, and it has a fairly wealthy Arizonense population that Esteban Ochoa, for example, represents, it has the financial, economic, and political capacity to put together and argue for private educational institutions. In other parts of the state, communities are still in the process of being made. And so places like Phoenix do not have established communities, do not have established religious institutions. They will not have established religious schools or colleges until much later. So folks in Phoenix, folks in St. John's, folks in Flagstaff, folks in Wickenburg are approaching the question of bilingual education and operating within the state regulations. There's no formal bilingual education program per se, but a teacher who's hired in a local community specifically to teach Spanish-speaking children is going to adapt or adopt some kind of bilingual education training program. How are you going to teach children who can't communicate with you and with whom you cannot communicate if you're not using more than one language?
It sounds, though, that there wasn't necessarily a consensus as to how best to do this, right? Like how best to teach non-native English speakers how best to speak English and study the rest of their subjects, even at that time.
No, there was no consensus on how to actually go through the process of teaching a child another language. There is consensus on the ideologies of the time period that children should be taught to speak English because this is Arizona Territory and Arizona Territory is part of the United States.
All right. Laura, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Laura Munoz is an assistant professor of history and ethnic studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Her debut book is called Desert Dreams, Mexican Arizona and the Politics of Educational Equality. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look into the long and troubled history of customs and border protection.
Finding bodies in the desert. And, you know, up until very, very recently, CBP as an agency didn't offer training around this. And there was a prevailing attitude within the agency, which frankly is still there today, which is pretty much suck it up, buttercup.
But first,
two Arizona Supreme Court justices who ruled to uphold an 1864 abortion ban earlier this year are facing a campaign to oust them via the ballot this November. Justices Clint Bolick and Catherine H. King are up for retention votes this fall, and now a conservative political activist has launched a campaign to try to convince voters not to oust them. Randy Kendrick, wife of Arizona Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick, said she wants to stop, quote, liberal groups from taking aim at the state Supreme Court. But Arizona Republic columnist E.J. Montini asks if it's liberal groups that she's protecting us from or just women who want to control their own health care. Good morning there, Ed.
Good morning.
Okay, so give us your take here to begin with. Like, what do you make of this effort by Randy Kendrick to protect these justices on the ballot this fall?
Well, I think it could be twofold or threefold. I mean, I do think that there is the notion of protecting the judges, particularly. But I also think there's a fear that should these judges be removed, that, you know, Governor Hobbs will have an opportunity to appoint new justices. There's that fear. And there's also just there's a fear on I think, the part of some that you're giving up like a significant portion of the power if the Supreme Court were to switch. Mm-hmm. So I think it's multi-leveled in some ways. And also, I think the people who have money like Randy Kendrick like to be part of the game. You know, they like to push their agenda, and they have the money to do it.
So I want to ask you about another layer of this, right? There are many, but this is all sort of complicated again by another effort by GOP lawmakers that they put on the ballot this fall too, which would give judges essentially lifetime terms on the state Supreme Court.
Right.
And it would be retroactive, right? So even if voters voted these two justices out on the ballot in November, they did not, you know, pass their retention votes. And if voters pass this referendum, they'd get to stay.
Yes, that is the sleaziest. Well, there are two sleazy aspects of that particular referendum that the Republican-controlled legislature put on the ballot. The first is that you're literally changing the rules, not because you think it's a good idea to change the rules, but just to protect a couple of people who you think are on your side, which is not the way you're supposed to change rules. And then the second thing is you're even, you know, the retroactive part. I mean, these two justices came onto the court under these provisions, and they knew it when they took the job. And so that's the provisions that should be judging them. It makes the most sense to do that. And, you know, you throw that thing on the ballot because you just want to confuse people, hopefully. That's their plan, I think. Because I believe, I mean, if you look at the national polls these days for, say, what President Biden was proposing for the Supreme Court, USA Today took a poll that said that like 75% of Americans thought there should be a code of conduct for the Supreme Court. Well, you know, the Arizona Supreme Court has a code of conduct. Hmm. You know, there was like a roughly the same amount thought that justices should only be limited to like 18-year terms. You know, well, Arizona has this provision that says, you know, we can vote you in, we can vote you out. I mean, there's an element to that. We are, in our own way, sort of ahead of the curve, and we have a legislature that's trying to put us back.
So I've done some interviews about this particular issue on the show before, and the other side of this seems to be that there's an argument that we don't want politics interfering with the way that justices rule, right? Like, they want to be able to do this without the pressure of outside groups, and that's why they should get these kind of lifetime appointments.
Yes, that's the ideal. The reality is that, as we all know, that's kind of bull. The fact is that there's a difference between having opinions, which is fine. Everybody has opinions. And I have no problem with justices that have opinions because of their people. They're regular people. They have it.
Right.
In the Judicial Code of Conduct in Arizona, it says that, you know, that if your opinions are an obvious problem, then you need to recuse yourself. Hmm. And if you're somebody like Bill Montgomery, who has been a vehement anti-abortion advocate, you know, participating in protests and talking, making speeches and being really inflammatory with your language. Well, come on. You know that that's further than you're supposed to go if you're going to try to maintain some element of fairness on a judicial level. So I think that it's a matter of degree. It's a sliding scale. It's a very hard thing to, you know, quantify. And that's what keeps justices, judges, whatever, from very rarely being sanctioned for their conduct, because it varies with the people who are looking at them, and it varies at the time that they're making those decisions.
Mm. So you're bringing up another kind of plot twist to all of this, another controversy over Justice Bill Montgomery, who you mentioned, who says he will not recuse himself from a case over the wording of the Arizona for Abortion Access Initiative that will be on the November ballot as well. The legislature wrote the wording to use the phrase unborn human being as opposed to fetus. A lower court said that's not fair. Now it's going to the state Supreme Court on appeal. Bill Montgomery, as you said, has been pretty outspoken in the past about his feelings about Planned Parenthood and abortion rights. Do you think this brings up bigger concerns about the ability of the people to trust in the court, not just at the Supreme Court, at the U.S. Supreme Court, but at the state level as well?
Yes, I do. I think it really very much does do that very thing, because he knows that that's inflammatory language. And, you know, the law says we're supposed to guard against inflammatory language. You're supposed to present the most neutral language you can when you're presenting those kind of propositions. I mean, Bill Montgomery's a smart guy. He knows exactly that it's a dog whistle kind of language, and he shouldn't be part of that. He would totally agree with it. That's the other thing. That's one of the reasons why you should recuse yourself. I mean, I understand the desire not to. That's a human aspect to this whole part. These are people who they're in a position where they can make these decisions, and it must be very tempting. But ultimately, if you're really doing your job, you're removing yourself, because that would be the ultimate form of demonstrating the fact that you can be an unbiased jurist.
Hmm. I had Justice Clint Bolick on the show, I think last year, when there was another debate about Justice Bill Montgomery stepping down from another major abortion decision. He didn't talk about that case or Justice Montgomery, but he did give a pretty hearty defense of justices recusing themselves in certain situations. Like, he recuses himself often when any case that comes before the state Supreme Court has to do with the state legislature, because, as we know, his wife is a state legislator. So I wonder, though, the difference between that kind of conflict of interest and having to step down then versus having a judicial philosophy, or versus having, as you said before, like a personal opinion.
Yeah, I think that it's fine. Like I said, the personal opinion part is fine. Mm-hmm. But when you're like an active participant in a particular issue, let's say a gun issue came up in front of the Supreme Court, or the state Supreme Court, or something like that, and you're not just a member of the NRA, but you have lobbied the legislature, or you have participated in events and stuff like that, it's all a matter of degree. I mean, if you're a person who just generally believes that the Second Amendment, guarantees the right for everybody to carry a firearm, I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. That's your opinion. That's fine. And you could, I'm sure, base your decision on the merits of the case. But if you've shown yourself to be like a zealous supporter that has gone into the realm of being, like an advocate, an outside advocate for the issue, then I think you have to recuse yourself. And that would be a big problem with the recent case with Bolick, again, when the Supreme Court dealt with work release programs for unionized members of municipalities. I mean, in that case, Bolick wrote the opinion outlawing essentially these work release for unions and municipalities like fire departments and police. Well, a few years ago, he was the Goldwater lawyer literally arguing to do that in front of a court, right? He was that much of an advocate. And now he's sitting on the Supreme Court, and the guys who were arguing in front of him were literally his colleagues from before. I had trouble with that as well. I mean, I just think that's where you cross the line.
All right. Lots more debate to be had here, I'm sure. That is Arizona Republic columnist E.J. Montini joining us. Ed, thanks as always for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Russia says it's evacuating people from a second region along its border with Ukraine. That comes after Ukraine launched an offensive inside Russia. Ukrainian President Zelensky confirmed that offensive, which started last Tuesday. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, what is the latest on this today?
Yeah, this story is developing really quickly today, Mark. Let's go back a bit first. You mentioned that last Tuesday Ukraine launched an incursion into Russian territory. That was something that was confirmed by Moscow last week, saying that a number of Ukrainian troops had crossed the border, attacking, I think it was initially four villages in the western Kursk region. The next day, Russia then said that the attacks had gone further and deeper into inside Russian territory. However, Kyiv, no official word from Kyiv for several days until this weekend, when, as you say, President Zelensky of Ukraine finally broke his silence, confirmed that an invasion, in his words, was taking place, and that Ukrainian troops were indeed across the border. Now, beyond that, the details are a little bit more sketchy. We don't know how many troops are actually inside Russia, or indeed how deep inside Russia they are. I've heard reports that it could be anywhere from 6 miles to 20 miles. But what we're hearing is that this is definitely something that's now taking place. And I think the most significant and important thing to note here is that the Russian public, the people inside Russia, know that this is now happening. And I think there's two things to ask, really. What are the objectives here? Because, you know, Ukraine is obviously a much smaller country than Russia. How far inside Russia does Ukraine want to go, and to what end? Remember, when Russia launched its invasion back in 2022, it was all supposed to be over within a matter of days. Mm-hmm. And here we are, you know, more than 2 years later, and the war still rages on. Now, despite that, Russia still says that everything's kind of going according to plan and that Russia is doing well. Well, if you have Ukrainian troops inside Russia controlling Russian towns, and we hear today that it might be as many as 28 towns in that Kursk region now under Ukrainian control, well, that does kind of fly in the face of anyone that might say, look, things are going well. If how well are things, you know, the Russian public might start to think, well, how well are things going if Ukrainian troops are on Russian soil? So I think that's what we need to look out for this week. How much further this is going to go on, how deeper into Russia the Ukrainian troops go, and what the response from Vladimir Putin is.
Right. So, Pete, let's move now to the conflict in Gaza. And amid renewed efforts to get Israel and Hamas back to the negotiating table, both sides could possibly meet later this week in Qatar. Is that right?
Yes, again, another story that's moving. It does seem that negotiation talks could take place, as you say, this Thursday. But there are still growing fears that the war in Gaza could turn into a wider regional conflict. That prompted the leaders of France, Germany and the United Kingdom to issue a joint statement calling on Iran and its allies to refrain from attacks. But it also called, they also called for an immediate resumption of negotiations about a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel responded to that at the end of last week and said that it was willing to get back around the negotiation table, but it brought some new stipulations with it. And there was no response from Hamas until yesterday, when it said, yes, it would be willing to negotiate. However, only under the previous terms of negotiation, which broke down in May. So it would not agree to these new factors or stipulations brought in by Israel. So that throws it up into the air. Another thing to mention, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has got two very important meetings coming up this week, which could affect whether he goes around or decides to join the negotiations. First of all, he's meeting Russia's President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday before heading to Turkey on Wednesday, where he'll meet that country's president, Erdogan. That's significant because following the assassination of the Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran just under 2 weeks ago, that was heavily criticized by the president of Turkey. So there's a lot of moving parts on this. There is some optimism that perhaps negotiations will start up again, but then at the same time, there's a lot of fear growing that this escalation is still got some way to go and could escalate and suck in other countries in the region.
Sure. All right, Pete. Finally, let's go to South Korea, where the government there is meeting to talk about measures to prevent electric vehicle fires after a recent spate of fires there involving EVs. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. South Korea's government essentially wants to bring in a whole new raft of regulations involving electric vehicles. And that's because, as you say, there's been a number of fires recently involving those vehicles and the batteries within them. A couple of bits of context here. First thing about battery fires or electric vehicle fires is that it's normally associated with the battery, and the batteries can burn at incredibly high temperatures. They're incredibly dangerous. Also, the problem might be slightly specific to Korea, because a lot of people live in apartment buildings, high-rise apartment buildings. The cars are parked in garages underneath those buildings, and if one battery was to go off, and it's very difficult to put out, that can then spread. So that's what happened in this most recent fire involving a Mercedes-Benz electric sedan with batteries produced by a Chinese company. The blaze occurred in one of these underground garages I mentioned in the city of Incheon, which is nearby Seoul. It took over 8 hours to extinguish and resulted in damage to approximately 140 vehicles, as well as dozens of people being hospitalized due to smoke inhalation. So this is something that industry experts are urging the government to get a handle on. in a market which is already experiencing pressures globally as well as locally. So this week, I would expect Korea to announce some stringent new measures on the manufacture of vehicles, and specifically who makes the batteries that goes in cars. Because at the moment in South Korea, manufacturers do not have to clearly state where those batteries are coming from. So they're expecting that. I think globally, people will be watching this, and manufacturers in other countries will be watching this, because as we know, the electric vehicle market, after the boost it's had in the last couple of years, is experiencing a global slowdown. So they will be watching. I would reckon market watchers will be waiting to see what the South Korean government, the rules that they introduced, because that could have a knock-on effect on the global market.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
And you are listening to the show.
Thanks for coming along with us for the show here on KJZZ. Here and Now coming up in just about 10 minutes. That starts at 10, and at 12:30, be with us for Today Explained. We topped out at 105 yesterday in Phoenix, right at average. Not much change for the next couple of days. We should be at about 106 today and tomorrow. Slight chance of showers tonight, and overnight lows in the upper 80s. Well, if the AC out on your vehicle, why not skip the costly repairs and follow Patricia from Cave Creek, who donated her 2012 Mercedes. Donate your old RV, car, or truck to KJZZ to support the unique stories and balanced news you rely on. Visit cars.kjzz.org. We have 97 degrees right now in Phoenix at 949.
KJZZ is supported by Water Heaters Only. Same-day water heater repair and replacement since 1968. Available 24 hours a day for residential or commercial projects. WaterHeatersOnly.com.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody, and joined now in the studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. So, as you both know, we're in the midst of yet another election cycle defined by immigration and border policy. And a new expose in Mother Jones reveals that Customs and Border Patrol may be concealing ongoing issues with sexual assault and abuse between agency supervisors and trainees. In the piece, reporter Erin Siegel McIntyre focuses on the alleged rape of an agent she calls Violet, which is not her real name, and uses that story to unravel CBP's long history of corruption. As McIntyre recently told me, CBP has a tendency to attribute allegations like Violet's to, quote, bad apples, but McIntyre's reporting suggests that's not the right framing.
I think the workplace culture of the Border Patrol is better described like this, right? Agents are more like pickles, and they're all in a jar. And they're packed in there, they're surrounded by brine, and that brine pickles you, right? It seeps in, you can't stop it. And, you know, for example, more than one former agent has told me, oh yeah, Tucson, that's the rapey sector. And, you know, I don't think agents are necessarily, for the most part, bad apple actors. I think they're workers who have adapted to specific station-level workplace culture.
Yeah. Well, those cultural problems acknowledged. In the case of Violet, there is notionally a regulation against fraternization between agents and their superiors. But from your reporting, it sounds like those rules are not always followed.
Yeah, that's a correct assessment. I've reported on multiple sexual assaults that have taken place at the academy, aside from Violet's. One of the most notable happened many years ago, and it's sort of known by a nickname, the Game of Smiles, or just Smiles. It involved an entire class of agents at the academy and instructors as well. It was a party that took place at an instructor's house one night. They were playing a sex game that sort of got out of control. There was heavy drinking. And over a dozen trainees ended up getting fired. It's also a case in which, you know, the Border Patrol has never publicly commented on what happened to the instructors who were there. We don't know if they stayed with the agency, if they left. And the same thing happened in Violet's case, right? When I asked CBP and the Border Patrol to comment, when I asked them many questions, sent them a whole list about this particular case, they didn't answer practically any of them. They provided sort of the blanket statements they usually give to the media, saying that they take all allegations seriously and that they're looking into it.
So one of the other elements here is that in an attempt to beef up recruitment, particularly in light of the Trump administration's focus on the border, the benchmarks around qualifications to become a CBP agent have been changed. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So when there are political mandates to expand the number of boots on the ground, you know, they'll say, hey, we're going to hire 5,000 more agents. And what tends to escape reality here is the fact that the agency already has a pretty difficult time staffing. And so when there are calls to expand, that only exacerbates an already tough situation. And so CBP tries to comply. And one of the ways they've done this is by doing what some would say is lowering standards or eliminating certain checks and balances for new agents. What that does at the end of the day is admit folks to serve as, you know, armed federal agents that maybe are not as qualified as they should be.
You know, this really underscores the very deep tragedy of this reporting that you've done, because the other really haunting line for me in your piece is, quote, being a Border Patrol agent is one of the least lethal jobs in law enforcement, but agents kill themselves at higher rates than actual police. Tell us more about the mental health struggles that you have found amongst CBP agents and what, if anything, is being done to address it.
Yeah. And when you talk to agents themselves, you know, there is a very familiar sort of trope that they say, and it is that they signed up to do a job because they wanted to serve their country in many cases. They wanted to help protect the borders. They wanted to chase bad guys, and that's what they thought they were signing up for. Yet once you are, I think, on the ground doing the job, you know, the bulk of a Border Patrol agent's work is hunting down people who are oftentimes in desperate situations. And it also involves, you know, finding bodies in the desert. And, you know, up until very, very recently, CBP as an agency didn't offer training around this. And there was a prevailing attitude within the agency, which frankly is still there today, which is pretty much suck it up, buttercup.
So this suck it up, buttercup attitude that is prevalent based on your reporting makes me think about the fact that Violet, to come back to her story, did not want to come forward when this incident happened to her. So even though the agency has such an issue with hiring and retaining agents, did she feel that she would be viewed as expendable if she became a quote-unquote problem?
I think what was probably going through her mind was the training she had been receiving, right? She had been there on the campus for weeks. And you got to keep in mind, this is a paramilitary training academy. It's boot camp. It is very tough. You are screamed at. You are cut down. They try to sort of psychologically level you in order to build you back up in their make and mold. And so agents are trained not to complain, not to speak out, especially not about a supervisor. And so when this assault allegedly happened, she confided in one of her classmates. And that classmate then did what they were supposed to do as a mandated reporter. They did call 911 that night, which is how I ended up ultimately finding police records.
Yes. And as you report, when you contacted the agency about the incident, they initially denied it. And it wasn't until you presented them with evidence from the transcript of the 911 call that they confirmed that something had indeed been reported.
Right. You know, I also asked CBP and the Border Patrol for records of all misconduct allegations over the past 20 years. And they gave me back a data set of just 186 complaints. This incident wasn't there. And there were also quite a few glaring omissions. From Arizona, for example, the case of the serial rapist Stephen Charles Holmes, former agent, he was at a Tucson sector, and he was arrested twice, once in 2019, once in 2021. You know, that case didn't show up. Another one, the 2009 Brian Dick rape case, also a former Border Patrol agent who was convicted of raping one of his colleagues, a female agent, that wasn't represented in this data set from the Border Patrol. It is hard to trust data when it comes from the government in relation to the Border Patrol and any of these cases.
And can you tell us where things stand currently with Violet's case?
I would love to be able to, Sam. All that the Border Patrol will say is that they are investigating, which, again, is something they never said until I brought the case to them. This case happened 5 years ago. Whether or not what they say is accurate is kind of anyone's guess. I hate to say that, but it's impossible to know.
All right. Well, a tough but very important story from our guest, investigative journalist Aaron Siegel McIntyre. Thank you for the conversation, Aaron, and thank you for your reporting.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. A reminder, you can always follow the show on Instagram. It's a pretty good follow. We're at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I am Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.